And members, first we will do the possible reconsideration work session regarding House Concurrent Resolution 3. Then a work session just on the introduction of some speaker-approved measure drafting requests. And then we will move on to public hearing first on House Bill 3442, then 3601. So with that then, we open up possible reconsideration work session on House Concurrent Resolution 3. Senator Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Concurrent Resolution 3.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on HCR 3. Discussion. Members, this was the Kip Lombard resolution last week that we had passed out, and as we had discussed, the Mr. Lombard had passed away actually within an hour or so of our passing that resolution, and so we were going to bring the resolution back for insertion of an amendment that places or makes this now a memorial for him. So, anyway, with that, any further discussion?
No. Mr. Chair, can I just ask, did Mr. Lombard know about the vote on the bill?
His wife was in communication with those individuals who had testified on that, like within an hour of the testimony. So I think she was aware, and I would presume that had been communicated. Okay. No further discussion? Then let's call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Chair Doyle. Aye. The concurrent resolution is then reconsidered.
And we did this one.
We did that one.
Okay. Reconsidered.
Oh, okay. Senator from the floor, maybe a second.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote on HCR 3.
Representative Flores has moved that we reconsider the vote on HCR 3. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so ordered. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand there are some amendments. We're trying to track them down. So if you want to go to another bill, maybe we can find them later in the hearing.
Oh, okay. Well, then let's just recess the possible reconsideration work session. I guess we're recessing now the work session on HCR 3. And let's open up a work session for possible consideration of speaker-approved measure drafting requests. And there are no speaker-approved bills.
No bills, right? Just measure requests, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the Rules and Public Affairs Committee request Legislative Council to prepare drafts as outlined in the two memos dated March 31, 2003.
Representative Flores has moved the committee to request Legislative Council prepare drafts as outlined in the two memos dated March 31, 2003. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll close the work session and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3442. Jim Bruneau, Gary Conklin.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruneau. I am the president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, but also the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, which is located just south of Salem, Oregon. I'm here to speak on behalf of this bill. This bill is focused on improving the Oregon wine industry's research and promotional activities, and I want to thank the chair very much for helping us with this, the development of this bill, and I appreciate very much coming to your committee. I also want to thank the vice chair and also the other leaders of the legislature in helping us find a legislative path that will move this legislation expeditiously through the legislature, and I'll get to the reasons why. Over the past 40 years, our industry in Oregon has gone from just an idea and a dream of a few California vintners, we call them refugees from California, who believed that it was Oregon, not California, that would make the great wines of that are of Burgundy origin, like Pinot Noir. And so they, over that period of time, came to Oregon with their vines. And since that time, the Oregon legislature developed a plan to help promote the research and marketing of Oregon wines. And in that, from that, just that very small beginning, the industry now has over 200 wineries, 550 commercial vineyards, employing thousands of Oregonians, paying millions in alcohol and property and other taxes, and utilizing what previously was undervalued hillside land to produce gorgeous vistas that now attract visitors from all over the world. The quality of Oregon products are now proudly carried, and the name of Oregon is proudly shown on tables, dinner tables all over the world as a result of the development that has occurred in this last 40 years. Oregon now ranks second in the country as a state in terms of number of producers. We rank fourth as a state in the volume that we produce. It was an amazing foresight that the industry and the legislature in partnership developed the plans to grow our industry. And the reason why we're here today is to tell you, despite our success, not all is well in Camelot. There are some improvements that need to be made in the structures that provide for our research and promotion. Now, over the last 2 years, the Oregon wine industry, through the Oregon Wine Advisory Board Task Force, the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which is the private nonprofit advocacy part of our industry, even a former governor, our industry's founders, who actually started the industry, worked together to develop a consensus among the players in the industry, which produced a letter to the industry asking for reform, signed by 250 principals of the wine industry, which resulted in regional meetings held throughout the state to develop a consensus on how the structure should be changed. This remarkable effort was led by people like David Adelsheim, whom you probably have heard of or know, and Ted Castile from Bethel Heights Winery, one of our founders, one of the industry's founders. And what we've got now is what isn't before you. Now, the legislation we have in front of you has amendments that are coming. You know, the bill that was, the information that was submitted to LC didn't quite come out the same way as we had hoped, and I think you're all familiar with that. And so we now have a new set of amendments to fix that, plus one other thing, and that is that the Attorney General has given us really good advice about how to address issues that relate to the U.S. Foods case, a case that where the Attorney General is asking that some defenses be built into statutes that deal with research and promotion of an agricultural product, such to make sure that they were interpreted to be government speech as opposed to compelled private speech. So that's just a side issue. But we have worked with the Attorney General to make sure that the language was reflective of his advice. And I think I'm not overstating the case. Now, this legislation has a number of features. One is the board will be smaller, from 11 to 9, which we feel will make it more effective. The board will, the members will be appointed by the governor, as presently they're appointed by the director of the Department of Agriculture, which we think will raise the level of importance and the quality of the service of the members on the board. The board members under this bill will be chosen by their ability to represent the entire state rather than specific regions, as is done now. And this regional diversity actually produced divisions and competition, which was unhealthy for the statewide promotional efforts of the board. We ask that the board be made semi-independent, that it no longer be a subset of the Department of Agriculture, that we no longer have to employ state employees or participate in PERS, which will produce, we think, much more efficient outcomes. Besides, the people who are involved in the activities of our industry really aren't seeking long-term government service, which that program, I think, is probably more suited for. The other is that another important feature of this proposal is that the board is required to develop a long-run strategic plan and to engage in projects that are coordinated and integrated to implement its strategic statewide objectives, and that this annual plan, under the AG's advice, be reviewed and approved prior to the commencement of the fiscal year, so that we pick up one of those defenses that he's recommending be put into the legislation. And the last is that we ask that this legislation be made effective as soon as we possibly can. And so that's the amendments will call for implementation date of July 1, which happens to be the fiscal year, the beginning of the fiscal year, and a great time to begin these reforms. We believe that this legislation has had a remarkable amount of effort over a period of 2 years invested in it, and we think there's a great deal of thought that's gone into it. Now, the reason why the rest of my colleagues haven't joined me here today in this hearing room is because we did not know that the hearing will be scheduled this day. We have a industry planning meeting held today where all the leaders of the industry are planning, developing their strategic plan for research and marketing today. And so I've been excused from the meeting for a period of time to come here.
Thank you. Huh? Any questions? Representative Berger.
Well, I have a couple of a question and a comment, I guess. The one that says the members will be chosen on the basis of their ability to represent the state. How are your members chosen? I'm not sure of what you're moving from and exactly the structure you're moving to.
Presently, the Oregon Wine Advisory Board members are selected to represent particular regions of the state. And they're also they have to meet certain criteria as to the type of producer they are, whether they're a grower, a winemaker, whether they make fruit wine, or berry wine or vinifer wines. And what has, we think the dynamic of that representation has been harmful to the group. And so the language we're asking in direction given to the governor who would make the appointments is that he consider that they have the ability and interest to represent the entire state as opposed to one particular, advocating for one particular region on the board, if you follow me.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Follow up.
My comment is, and then I discussed this with Gary before, I think this is the right gentleman that I wanted to talk about added value. Is this the right gentleman? I had a discussion about the marketing part because I think that Oregon wines are wonderful and I think that they can be put up against any wines worldwide.
Thank you.
But in the marketing, I wondered if we weren't missing an opportunity that there is a gap in some of our ability to market to other nations. For instance, in my part of Oregon, which is the Southern Oregon coast, we have an ample supply of shrimp. And yet we don't have any Cajun shrimp. We don't have shrimp that are packaged and sent to, let's say, China. Even if they have shrimp, they may not have the Cajun style. And I would just visualize some of that added value being put with certain wines that would be marketed. Has this discussion taken place in your marketing?
Well, the Oregon wine industry, because of the way it's presently organized, is very dysfunctional and has difficulty in developing the types of effective marketing plans that you've just described. Now, if you read last Sunday's Oregonian, Catherine Cole wrote an article about the success of the Washington wine industry. And she finished that article in the Oregonian by wondering why Oregon was not doing the very things that you described. And if I'd be happy to give you a copy of the article.
I didn't see the article.
And she ended with pointing out the dysfunction that the Oregon wine industry is presently suffering under because of our structures, but also advocating and looking forward to the change and referencing this bill, actually, in her article. So what I'm telling you is that, yes, we have many shortcomings, and we need to be far better focused than we are, and we think this legislative direction will provide that to us.
Any other questions? Okay, we understand there's still some amendments that are being worked on.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Gary Conklin, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. As Mr. Bruneau indicated, there were some omissions from our original submission to the Legislative Council. We've also gotten some suggestions from the Attorney General, one more of a procedural nature, We adopted that, and also one referring to this issue of oversight to defense in the U.S. Foods case, again, as Mr. Bernal mentioned. And I might also note, somewhat to our surprise, I don't want to necessarily say to our chagrin, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, as I understand it, related to the fact that there is a continuing appropriation for the resources that go to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, and that would then go to the successor, the Oregon Wine Board. And with the assistance, good assistance of your staff, hopefully we can see if it's possible to address that issue in this particular committee. And if possible, we would certainly ask for your help, and ultimately we understand it requires the Speaker's approval, to not send it on that journey, but rather to send it towards the floor and then the Senate. But if necessary, we'll do what it takes. But we at least want to explore that. So with your leave, our hope is that we'll have all of that wrapped up by early next week.
Okay, great. With that in mind, then, we will look to bring this back up next Tuesday and week from today. Hopefully have a work session on it. Great. Thank you. Anything further? All right. Thank you. And no others appearing to testify, so we can close the public hearing on 3442. Colleagues, on the reconsideration of HCR 3, we will not have those amendments, so we had put that in recess, so now we'll just go ahead and close that hearing as well. And we can open up House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 3601. Representative Smith. And Colonel Caldwell as well. Yes.
Well, thank you, Chair Doyle, for having us. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent District 52. And I'm here today because I heard from a constituent all summer, in fact, about how we don't protect our National Guard State Service employees. And I'm sure you're all, we all know what's going on and how important this is and the service that these people give for all of us. So I'm very proud to be here today in support of House Bill 3601. And the U.S. Congress passed the Soldier and Sailors Civil Relief Act to cover National Guard this last fall, but they didn't cover the state when people were called up for state service. So that's what this bill does. This is for people who are called within the state, and I'm sure the Colonel can fill you in more on that. But that's what this bill is going to do, is going to give some relief to these people who are called up when we fight forest fires and when we do floods. And as we have known, our Oregon National Guard is one of the best, and they're being deployed all over. But within our state, we oftentimes use them. So that's the goal of this bill. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, and now let the Colonel.
Okay. Would you like to stay a few moments?
Sure.
Through Colonel Caldwell's testimony? Okay.
You bet.
Colonel Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the record. I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and we'd like to express our support for House Bill 3601. The bill, as the representative has told you, does take a large step in connecting some holes between the federal legislation that's in existence to protect soldiers, sailors, and seamen and airmen. And in our case, the Oregon National Guard's 8,000 members, both Army and Air National Guard, and we cover, we have 44 armories, 2 air bases, 5 major training areas, and we are literally in almost every city in the state. This bill does try to protect those people who, for whatever reason, are called at the call to governor for over 30 days is really what it boils down to. This is not a normal situation. Frankly, most of our state active duty call-ups are 2 to 3 weeks, and that's a fairly long time. However, last year was, it seems like everything's, between this year and last year, we seem to have broken all rules and all records, and Last year we were on fire duty literally from about the end of May until the 1st of September, and I'm sure you remember those drastic situations we had all over the state with the forests on fire, and some of our members were on active duty for, on state active duty for over 90 days. At the height, we had almost 2,200 National Guardsmen, both Army and Air, serving in support of the fires. I think that was unusual. I think it certainly isn't something that we would normally forecast. But we're living in a different world these days, too. And we don't know, with respect to Homeland Defense, Homeland Security issues, you know, what the next mission may be. And also at the federal level, there's still a lot of uncertainty as to how we're going to do some of these roles. This administration and the Congress are still trying to work out the roles of the Guard with respect to Homeland Security and Homeland Defense, and we're not real certain exactly where we're going to fall into that. Could be that we're under Title 32 status, or we could be under the total control of the governor and state status funded by the federal government. We're not sure. Those issues are still being debated. So I think this bill goes a long way in case something does come down the path in between now and, say, the next session of this legislature, that we have protection for people who end up in a circumstance that's perhaps beyond their control because of their deployment. And I think that's the good news. I have not had a chance to talk to the representative, but we had some additional changes that we would like to see if we could actually work into this today, and I know you'd like to see it move, and I apologize for this, but our lawyers just got this to me this morning, and so I was hoping that if we do decide, if the committee does elect to do that, that we could add some rather minor details in our mind, but also maybe help satisfy some concerns that could come up from landlords, perhaps. And so that was one of the issues that we were working on, and this came to our attention from one of our members who's a landlord. And being a landlord of myself, I also understand that, so I was hoping that we could make some minor adjustments. But pending your questions, that concludes my testimony.
Okay. Questions? Representative Plus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to comment that I greatly support this bill. During World War II, when my dad was a serviceman, there was federal regulation that the returning servicemen would be given their jobs back. And after 4 years, that was a tumultuous thing to do because people had replaced them. So we have a very honored history of honoring our servicemen with special privileges for their service. So I think this is a very good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Paul, can you kind of expand a bit on your proposed amendments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. Under Section 2 of the it requires 90 days outside of the area, and we would request that the it also in ORS 90, this is technical, but ORS 90.475 requires 90 days outside the area. We just want to connect this bill with what's already in the language under Section 2. Under Section 2 also, line 3, line 10, after the word effective, add the date the sooner of, which again is housekeeping, but we think it'll reflect better what we're trying to get at. Under Section 4, we would actually like to add a section, and under Section 4, where this is talking about creditors and interest, we would like to say creditors must recompute the payment schedule to amortize the loan balance over the remainder of the loan at the interest rate determined under this section. So they don't extend loans, they just re-amortize when it gets better for the service member. Under Section 7, line 26, it currently reads, and this is the one that we thought would probably be a little bit hard on renters, perhaps, or landlords. It currently reads, if the defendant requests a stay of the eviction up to 90 days, the defendant can prove that the ability of the defendant to pay the agreed amount rent is materially affected by being called into active service. The court, and it now reads, must grant the stay of eviction. We're saying may grant gives the court the, you know, doesn't demand the court has to do something, gives them that option. Under Section 9, again, line 36, same page, we have a similar situation where it says the court, after appropriate notice of the hearing, shall grant relief, and we've said may grant relief, again, given that option to the court. our guys aren't always right, we figured, so there may be some option there. And then section 9, line 40, we put, and it talks about a, this is where it talks about, for a stay of civil judicial proceeding in which state service member is a party, the court reads now, after appropriate notice and hearing, shall grant. We're saying take the words "and hearing" out, because it's basically requires a member to come to the hearing. That's the whole problem to begin with, is that they can't come to the hearing, so we want to get rid of that. In section 9, we would add a new section that would read...
Well, can I stop you on that?
Yes, sir.
After hearing, are you going to still have shall grant?
Yes.
So they...
They give them the stay so they can come back and have hear their case and do their pleadings, but they don't... They just give them the, they give them the stay as opposed to making them come to a hearing and then getting the stay.
Right. Okay.
Section 9, we'd add a new section that an application under this section does not constitute consent jurisdiction to the court. And this was, some of our members live in Washington, Idaho, California, across border. Mm-hmm. And this could be prohibitive for them if they're a cross-border resident, but actually in the Oregon National Guard. And so that came out of that discussion as to maybe they're giving up a right they shouldn't give up. And the last few items was that we did not catch until absolutely I was walking out the door. And we think it goes in Section 2, but we're not sure. And this may be take a legal, let's say, counsel to work with. That we should also add members that are serving in active guard reserve status under Title 32. And to explain that, these are Oregon Guardsmen under U.S. Code Title 32 under the control of the governor. But they are active guardsmen, so they actually have everything that a federal active duty person has, pay, benefits, and everything, and we can we treat them as such, where we can move them in an instant, we can move them on a moment. And this also is what I was talking about, Homeland Security, Homeland Defense. This could be real important that we have this in here for those classifications of people. So we would like to add that, and that may not be the right spot, but we thought we'd let Legislative Council figure that one out. And the last item that I was just informed of was that we may be better off to take out, and I think your office, Mr. Chairman, was spoken to about the driver's license issue. We may have a better deal the way we're doing it right now, and that is the deal, Motor Vehicles has been extremely lenient with respect to... I know they have a representative in the room, and you may want to hear from them as to how they currently handle driver's license issues. But I would prefer you talk to them before we move out on that.
Okay.
That's it.
Good.
And again, I apologize. I thought we'd done this once, but we have our Judge Advocate General Corps is, again, they're part-time attorneys, and they, the one who did the most work on this was out of town. He got to it and got it to me this morning. So he said, God, don't let this go here. I've got all this wonderful stuff. And I guess he's a pretty good attorney, so I'll have to listen to him.
Okay. Well, then it's with your consent, Representative Smith, we'll just see about getting those amendments put together.
I was particularly pleased to hear about the Section
32.
Title
32,
right?
Title 32.
That's what we were trying to
get over this. We actually headed down that path
initially.
Yeah. And then we kind of diverted off of it to look at state active duty only, and then at the 11th hour we said, we're not covered. These folks are not covered under any statutory language. And they're under the total control of the governor. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, good. Well, then let's go ahead and we just get those amendments drafted, and as soon as they're ready, we'll take it up again. And it's our intention, I think, to get this moved out as quick as we can, in basically in recognition of what many of our members are going, our National Guard members are going through right now. Anything we can do to show that support. Representative Berger.
I was just concerned, Mr. Chairman, as to whether this was a problem immediately for people who are now being called into service, and the rental part is... is kind of in limbo. I don't know that there's anything that we could do if the bill will take some time in getting through the process. Is there anything at all that it, do you know of anybody that is having the problem right now as a result of the war?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, to my knowledge, no. But Again, this would pretty much just affect those that are on state active duty, which we have done at this point. This legislation would. To answer the broader question, we've currently got right at 1,500 Oregon National Guardsmen who have been called to federal active duty. The last unit that was called was last week, which is one of the largest, had over 400 members. And we have a multitude of different phenomenons that we don't typically deal with landing on our lap these days, and that includes everything from a plugged sewer, which is pretty common. Nothing broke in my house unless I was deployed, I can guarantee you that, in my 32 years. It always worked fine when I was there. The minute I was deployed, it broke. And that's pretty much what we've been dealing with. We've had a couple of other items that are rather unique in the sense that insurance issues, and again, there's been some activity on the federal level to try to correct some of that in TRICARE, which is the insurance policy. That doesn't mean to say we don't have some issues, because we do. But right now, we've been able to handle most of them. They haven't really hit us in a real big manner. But again, we're really early in this deployment as well, too.
I would like to answer to that, too. This bill came about because of a constituent who was contacted last summer because they were continuing to cross and it was enforced by the courts.
Let me ask you, too, Colonel Caldwell, with the fact that this bill does not have an emergency clause, that means then it won't take effect until 2004?
Mr. Chairman,
what impact is that?
We just had that sidebar here, and we think probably we should add that, too.
Okay.
So I wrote that down as a note.
Okay, good. All right, well, let's see if we can get that moved along fairly quickly, and we'll see what we can do about getting it out.
Appreciate your time and indulgence.
Okay. No others.
Mr. Chair.
Oh yes, Representative Backlund.
Colonel Caldwell made a reference to licenses, and the fact is that DMV does have a representative here. I'm wondering if we could hear some details on that.
I think we're going to be working on some other amendments.
Okay.
I'd rather wait
before
you do that. Okay. Thank you.
All right,
with that then, we will close public hearing on House Bill 3601. And that's all we had on our agenda today, members. And we will close here. We're adjourned.
Start late.